a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we.
Good morning and welcome to Eco Talk, and this is an ignorance-free zone. We are taking our heads out of the sand on a very big story that was in the New York Times this morning. We are taping this program on Wednesday, a few days before you're hearing it, most likely on Sunday morning. We kind of moved our show around because we think this is too important to ignore, talking about the New York Times article showing that a White House official played down the link between emissions and global warming in her internal report, and we're going to get some commentary from both sides of that. We're going to talk to a scientist, the Union of Concerned Scientists, Brenda Eckwurzel. We're also going to speak with Myron Ebell. He's the director of the Climate Policy Competitive Enterprise Institute. They have been sort of doubting that climate change is caused by human activity, and so I appreciate both of them being available on short notice to comment on this story. Our second half will be a chat with an author, Richard Loeb, who's written a very intriguing book. The title itself is intriguing. It's called Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. So stay tuned for that. But first, just a couple of words on the World Environment Day week, which just wrapped up a few days ago, the highlight of which was Al Gore's presentation, which he made to three different audiences, sort of the eco-activists, private smaller dinner, and then sort of the well-heeled crowd at the last gala event Saturday night. And he gave about a 40-minute slide presentation on documenting the effects already documented on global warming, climate change, showing glaciers that were there that are not there now, talking about population, you know, a spike really in the population growth. He shows a chart which, you know, is a steady, steady, steady growth with population, and all of a sudden it spikes up. He said in his lifetime, the world's population has grown from, I think it was 2.9 billion to an expected 9 billion. And with that rise in population, of course, comes extra demand, you know, for food, fuel, all of our life-sustaining resources, and with technology out there like coal and oil, you know, we are exponentially, rapidly leading up to what Al Gore calls humanity's collision with the planet. So having come off of that, and it was a real big call to action by a lot of people, but Al Gore was sort of the star person presenting this latest data, and then seeing this article showing that there was some editing of documents on climate issues, just had to get some reaction to that. So I want to introduce our guest, Brenda Eckwurzel, with the Union of Scientists, Concerned Scientists, and I bet you're very concerned about this, Brenda.
Yes, I am. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Thank you. I just want to make sure we have Myron Ebell also from the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so I just, for those of you who didn't see the story, let me just give a quick recap and then we'll jump right in. So a White House official who once led the oil industry's fight against limits on greenhouse gases has repeatedly edited government climate reports in ways that play down links between such emissions and global warming. That according to internal documents, Mr. Philip Cooney is the man we're speaking of. He's chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality. That is the office that helps devise and promote administration policies on environmental issues. Now, before coming to the White House in 2001, he was the climate team leader and a lobbyist at the American Petroleum Institute. That is the largest trade group representing the interests of the oil industry. He's a lawyer, interestingly, with a bachelor's degree in economics and has no scientific training. This was in the New York Times, and a White House official said that the changes made by Mr. Cooney were part of the normal interagency review that takes place on all documents related to global environmental change. All comments are reviewed, and some are accepted, some are rejected. That according to Robert Hopkins, a spokesman for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, he noted that one of the reports Mr. Cooney worked on, the administration's 10-year plan for climate research, was strongly endorsed by the National Academy of Scientists. So let's first go to Myron Ebell and see what you have to say, because you're defending this.
Well, I think that what the White House has said is exactly correct. The CEQ is charged with interagency review of policies and documents that come out of the various government departments. When you've got a thing as large and as varied as the federal government, the president has very limited means of enforcing his policies consistently throughout all the departments. An interagency review process within the White House is one way, is the principal way of doing that. And so what Phil was doing is what CEQ has done and people at CEQ have done since it was created, and that includes both Republican and Democratic administrations. I don't remember, for example, in the Clinton administration, the chairman, Katie McGitty, or her staff being scientists. They were, in fact, they were mostly lawyers, just like the current one. The current CEQ chairman and Phil Cooney are both lawyers.
Maybe they should have some scientists in there.
Well, they actually, this CEQ does have a climate specialist who is a scientist. I don't think he was on board when this particular document was reviewed. So it seems to me that the reason this is a story is not because it's anything different than standard operating procedure in previous administrations, but because the Bush White House is so successfully secretive about how it does its work and how it deliberates that whenever any little piece of information dribbles out, it's a big story. And I could see that because, you know, when it's very hard to understand how they operate and how they make their decisions, any little glimpse is news.
So are you saying it's good to be secretive? You said successfully secretive.
No, it drives me crazy.
Good. We have that in common.
They're secretive with their allies as well as with the press. I mean, I think it's wrong in both cases. But
makes you wonder what they have to hide. Hello?
Yes. I don't think they have anything to hide, but I think that the president has a belief that letting things get out before they're finished and ready to go has bad consequences, and he wants a very tight ship that runs in a very businesslike way, and that any sort of dealings with the media or letting these fights get out into public is a distraction. I don't know, but it looks to me that that's why they're so secretive.
It's completely gone through the spin cycle on the machine, I guess. Brenda, your comments.
Well, I believe that the scientist, Dr. Pilz, who worked within the agency that's now called Climate Change Science Program, what his major concerns are that the scientists do not have final review of the scientific integrity that's maintained within the final documents. So that, for example, the issues that were raised within Andrew Revkin's New York Times article were issues of changing the language to increase the perception of uncertainty, which is in contrast to the many, many professional societies that represent scientists who study climate, as well as just this week, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, along with the National Science Academies of 10 other nations, issued a joint statement saying that the scientific understanding of climate change is now sufficiently clear to justify nations taking prompt action. And they go on to urge the G8 to consider many of their proposals in this joint statement.
And just to sort of underline what you just said, the documents were obtained by the New York Times, the ones we're speaking about, from the Government Accountability Project. That is a nonprofit legal assistance group for government whistleblowers. The project is representing Rick Pilz, the man you mentioned, who resigned in March after a decade working in the office that coordinates government climate research and issued the documents that Mr. Cooney edited. Wanted to just clarify that for anyone who might just be joining us. We are speaking with Brenda Eckwurzel. She's a scientist, expert in climate change with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Myronie Bell, Director of Climate Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Let me just ask you a very basic question, Mr. Bell. Is climate change real?
Sure, the climate's always changing, and human beings have some impact on it.
And it's never changed like this, if you believe the graphs that Al Gore showed us at this World Environment Day conference. There was a pimple way back when in the Dark Ages, and then now there's like a triangle building.
Well,
not so slowly.
I think that further research has shown that that particular graph is will not hold up to much scientific scrutiny. It's clear that
there was more than one, I have to say.
Well, yeah. The global mean temperature varies all the time. It's either going up or it's going down. And within that, you find a lot of regional climate change going both ways. For example, if you look at the climate, the mean temperature of the United States throughout the 20th century, it went up, it went down, and it went up again. It was, if you looked at the entire century, it was flat. But within that, there are big changes. For example, at the end of the century, you find a long-term warming trend in the Pacific Northwest. You find a long-term cooling trend in the Atlantic Southeast. those are realities. I think people have to deal with them. The impacts are...
Well, it's fossil fuels that we're burning that's adding to the exponential rise. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't think there is an exponential rise. There has been a very slight rise in the temperature since about 1900, and some of that came towards the end of the century. But I don't deny that human beings are probably responsible for that rise. But the fact is that it's well within natural variability. The medieval warm period was clearly warmer than it is today.
Okay, that was back in the Dark Ages, as we said, though. This is something else. We're going to be right back. You're listening to Eco Talk on the Air America Radio Network. Welcome back to Eco Talk, and we are speaking with Brenda Eckwurzel with the Union of Concerned Scientists and Myron E. Bell with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, responding to an article in the New York Times about the editing of a document on climate change and what the threat is. This editing goes back a couple of years, but word is just getting out now. I wanted to give Brenda a chance to respond to the comments that we heard just before the break.
Yes. Well, there are other things besides temperature to look at. First of all, carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping greenhouse gases play a crucial role in determining our climate. By holding heat that would otherwise escape into space and reflect some of that energy back down to the Earth, heating up the Earth. And recently, we have had an unprecedented rise in carbon dioxide. In fact, scientists can go to the ice caps in both poles, and they can measure gas that has been trapped in the ice, archiving ancient air, and measure ancient carbon dioxide levels. And what we see is that carbon dioxide today is higher than it's ever been in the past 400,000 years.
Yes, that's unprecedented, as you say. Perhaps that's a better word than exponential. So Myron E. Bell, who's been campaigning against limits on greenhouse gases as director of climate policy at CEI, why are you so against restrictions, given this mounting scientific evidence? Some would say there's not even any question that this is real, we're causing it, and that it's happening rapidly. You think this is just going to go away, or is it going to go, is it going to get worse if we continue the status quo?
First, I don't accept that there is a consensus in favor of global warming alarmism. Second, the predictions of how sensitive the climate is to carbon dioxide and how much warmer additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere may make the planet are based on not on history but on computer models that use implausible and in some cases impossible assumptions. Second, I think that the impacts of climate change, particularly warming, more so than cooling, have been terribly exaggerated, in many cases simply falsified. And third, I think that the global warming policies being proposed, for example, in the Kyoto Treaty of 97 and the McCain-Lieberman legislation in the Senate, are actually much more of a threat than is future global warming. However, having said that, I do want to say that I think that the debate that goes on is oftentimes mischaracterized as one of science versus economics. That is, what's happening scientifically versus how much is it going to cost. If I believe that, I would be on the side of let's do something, because I think the science is primary.
Okay, so would you say, Brenda Eckwurzel, that there is any doubt really in the scientific community about whether this is real? I mean, in a way, I shouldn't even be having this conversation, because we have, you know, aired both sides of this, and I came away convinced that this is real. Most everybody I talk to is convinced it's real. And I just would like you to respond, and then I just want to ask Myron E. Bell, you know, assume they're right for a minute, and this is happening. Why fight it? Look at the stakes if this is, in fact, you know, where we're headed.
I would say that many people who have a chance to educate themselves about the evidence, they come away convinced just like you have. And other people like Lord Brown, who is CEO of British Petroleum, have found that they have instituted emission reductions for their company, and they found the first 3 years that they did that, they added $650 million of value of investment. And what they found is that businesses around the world are starting to find the benefits of reducing their ecological footprint by reducing their heat-trapping gases emissions and increasing efficiency. And Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger just said last week, he quote, "I say the debate is over. We have the science, we see the threat, and we know the time for action is now."
Okay, and he's a Republican in Bush's corner, so let's get a response from Mr. Ebell on that.
Well, even if you accept global warming alarmism, the idea that we're going to address it through putting the world on an energy diet is not only dubious from just looking at the way the world economy works.
You don't think the U.S. needs to go on an energy diet? We are the most wasteful, consuming country of fossil fuels ever.
No, we produce more than any. We produce. We use about 25% of the world's energy, and we produce about 30% of the world's wealth.
And we're 4% of the world's population.
I don't think we're. Well, it just shows how efficient and what great wealth producers we are in this country,
or how
free markets and our system of limited government,
or how gluttonous and wasteful we are.
But the fact is, if you look, for example, at the European Union meeting their Kyoto targets, they have much easier targets that were negotiated in '97 than the United States does. Now, leaving that aside, are they meeting them? The protocol has gone into force. They've been planning for how to meet the targets, which go into effect in 2008. The European Union's own projections show that 13 of the 15 countries are going to miss their targets by wide margins. And in some of these cases, we're talking about 50% above 1990 levels.
But we have to start somewhere.
Below.
And some 151 U.S. mayors have just signed Kyoto-like accords because they feel like the federal government's not leading the way. I want to let you have the last word, Brenda Eckwurzel. We have 30 seconds left.
Okay, I just want to say that renewable energy would create jobs here in the United States. I would have a wonderful future if we could use the energy, fossil fuel energy we produce domestically and not have to import 60% of it from abroad, and instead meet the growing demands of our energy demands
Thank
by
you.
Renewable energy.
Thanks. We're out of time. We'll be right back. You're listening to EcoTalk on Air America Radio.